If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Let me be clear. You are listening to the Red Box podcast from The Times.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Welcome to this part one of our end of term special, casting a critical eye back over the first half of what we are already calling the most dramatic year in British politics since last year. Joining me to examine the big beasts and small fry who make Westminster tick are three professional prickers of political pomposity. Jan Ravens, the impressionist who's given voices to our leaders on Spitting Image and Dead Ringers. Patrick Kidd, the sketch writer and diarist for The Times, who gives them a kicking in print. And Peter Brooks, the Times cartoonist, who mocks the mighty in beautiful watercolours. Welcome to you all. I just want to start off with you by just discussing how you go about sending up a politician. And obviously, you all do it, but in very different ways. And what do you look for when you're going to stick the boot in? Let's start with you, Jan.
Well, I think it depends on the politician. It depends on the politician. With Theresa May, for example, it was very hard to get a handle on her because I was longing to do her, you know, when she was Home Secretary, and I was, you know, saying to all the writers of Dead Ringers, come on, we've got to do Theresa May. You know, there's few enough women. We've got to do Theresa May. But of course, she never said anything. You know, she never said a bloody word. She'd always send James Brokenshire out to do the immigration figures, which were inevitably terrible. And she just sort of hid away. But when she sort of inexplicably and as much a surprise to herself as anybody became leader and therefore prime minister, when she stepped out on the step at the front of Downing Street and made that speech, and it was, you know, do you know that if you're born poor you will die up to 4 years earlier than other people, if you're black you'll be more poorly treated by the criminal justice system than if you... You know, she just went into this sort of whole Francis of Assisi kind of rhetoric thing. And it was the sort of longest, really, that I'd ever heard her talk, apart from when she was bollocking the Police Federation. And and what sort of struck me was the sort of that it was all about tension. It's all about tension with her. And it's all about embarrassment, I think. It's all about not being spontaneous. It's all about not feeling authentic with what she says. I mean, I think, you know, she has this very, very tense mouth, which is almost sort of like, you know, she wants to smile, but the rest of her face won't let her. And this diaphonic two-tone voice. But I think what the voice and her physicality says about her politically is this, the idea that she's not a conviction politician, that she hasn't really got a plan, I don't think. She's there, it's a pragmatic sort of thing. She was the person that was there at the time. She's taken it over. She's doing her best. She's not inspired. And I think that disconnect, you know, that having after the whole disastrous election campaign where she had to sort of, you know, parrot Strong and Stable endlessly, I think she I think, you know, even she said, you know, I was really fed up with how often I had to say it didn't feel right. And we were all thinking, you know, exactly that, you know, weeks before. I think she hasn't got a thing that she really wants to say. And so she says what she's told and she takes advice often from the wrong people.
So how long do you sort of spend studying Theresa May? Do you watch like that speech endlessly, or do you just...
I watched it quite a lot. I mean, some characters leap out at you and some characters don't. She didn't leap out at me, and all the time she was Home Secretary, I really struggled with her. And I used to sort of use... She used cliches a lot, even then. You know, well, going forward and circling back, you know, let me be clear that, you know, and it was all sort of just like gobbledygook and cliche. But I think, you know, now she's been revealed as a sort of a woman who's almost embarrassed by what she's having to do. And I feel there's two sort of... You know, I feel sort of empathy for her as a woman, as a human being. I feel like, you know, she's been brave. You know, she's been brave to stick it out. You know, when Cameron got the referendum result, you couldn't see him for dust. And like, right, there we go, that's me done. Whereas she's kind of stuck it out. And yet, I feel that if she was really brave and really, you know, then she'd have done something more about getting some decent negotiators in, you know, for Brexit. And she would have felt confident to kind of say, okay, you know, we're in this mess now, let's make a better job of sorting it out.
So Patrick, while we're talking about Theresa May, is she an easy person to sketch when you're writing the sketch in the Times?
Not for me, actually, because I never like to repeat jokes, which is probably a bad thing. You can do the voice over and over again, and Peter, you're drawing her every day, and I try and find a different way to describe her. One of my favourite ways of describing her was being like the sort of the madame in a particularly snooty French bistro. She's got that sort of beakish look to her when she comes out and tells you that nothing's on the menu and how dare you ask. But my colleague, John Crace, a lovely man, yes, and a dear friend on The Guardian, came up with the thing that defined her, the Maybot.
Yes. Yes.
And I saw he wrote this over and over again. And I started to think, oh, come on, John, think of something new. But actually, it just goes to show, you need, yes, to repeat it. You need to keep saying it, to drawing it. And so there we are, giving her criticism for saying strong and stable over and over again in the hope that the 15th time someone will listen. And actually, if we've been mocking them, sometimes we need to mock over and over again in the same fashion. And all credit to John for,
yes,
for getting to the nub of her. The Maybot works brilliantly.
Yes, the Maybot is very sort of, it's very resonant, isn't it? And also, he wrote a piece the other day where he described, used this phrase that I thought was so damning. And I wondered if it would have been used of a man, this phrase, inner mediocrity. And she, I see what he means. I mean, she can't be a totally mediocre person. She's the blooming prime minister, you know. But
it's not a time of giants in politics.
No,
there, is it?
It really isn't. No. But inner mediocrity is such a terrible thing to say about somebody, isn't it? It's so damning.
When obviously it should be said about Liz Truss rather than Theresa May.
Well, yeah, if we're gonna, yeah.
Peter, Theresa May, is she a good person to draw?
Oh, very.
Yeah. What makes her good?
Well, the strange thing is, I mean, listening to what Jan was saying about her being Home Secretary, of course, I and other cartoonists drew her loads of times as Home Secretary. But it's not until the camera is on them, until the spotlight is on them, that you actually concentrate in a, you know, sort of meaningful, yeah, way. It's the same with Trump and others as well, mind you. With her, it's a question of... I don't draw as... I have done characters as running gags, if you like, before. I did Ed Miliband as Wallace of Wallace and Gromit for 5 years. And
that really stuck and
yeah, it did.
Damaged him.
I think it did. And, you know, sort of... And it did have some sort of purpose in terms of cartooning for me, that every time I wanted to draw him, that's the way I drew him. But I haven't done that with, and with Cameron, I drew him as public school toff and Clegg was his fag. So there was that running gag, not all the time, but quite frequently. But with her, I haven't come up with anything, only because I think her actual look itself is almost enough. She has her own props. She's got obviously those leopard print shoes that you could just show the bottom of her ankles downwards and you'd know who it was. And people do that, and I've done that a few times. I've had her in a coffin with her feet sticking out and she's obviously Theresa May, you know. And you can do that with other you know, she wears these ridiculous sort of necklaces, which are huge.
Chunky necklaces.
I was told that she wears them to divert attention away from her beaky nose.
Yeah, well...
The trouble is when you draw her with a beak as well.
The beaky nose is kind
and the asymmetric neckline.
Yeah. Dramatic jackets
and
things
and
like that.
And two short skirts. I mean, for a head day, I put it this way, but I will, for a lady of her age, you know, I think it's a bit daft, you know. Pretty awful, I think.
I think it's quite interesting, her clothes sense. I think she's got better clothes sense than... I mean, of course, the annoying thing is that as a woman, your clothes sense is commented on. I mean, I don't think her skirts are too short. I mean, she's got good legs. She's, you know, she doesn't wear them above the knee. She wears them on the knee.
Oh, she does. She does wear them above the knee. Well, they appear above the knee.
Well, maybe they slip up when she sits down.
And there's the odd attempt at décolletage as well.
Which is daft, ill-advised.
You know, I just don't think... You know, she's sort of acting, you know, it's a sort of minor point because we're just talking about appearance and not policy.
Do you think there's a gallantry issue, though, in referring to a female politician's appearance? So, for instance, at her first PMQs, I noticed she was wearing these scarlet shoes and her fingertips matched it. And I wrote in a line about being red in hoof and claw. And I got comments underneath from people saying, you wouldn't talk about a man's appearance.
Yeah,
I write about Boris's hair all the time. And you know, about...
And if David Cameron had turned up with red fingernails and matching shoes, you probably would have written about it. But I think
some
readers
felt that you shouldn't make any comment that Theresa May is more than shoes, which of course she is.
Well, she is more than shoes. And I do think that, you know, the kitten heels did become a really boring joke quite quickly.
Yeah,
you know, it's like Trump's small hands.
Yeah.
You know, you think, can you think of another one now, please? You know.
Well, he's got other things as well, of course. You know, those are just a small part of,
of what
you're drawing.
Indeed.
You know?
And so who else is good? Who else do you like?
Trump.
You like doing Trump?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's been put that, you know, it's difficult to do a joke about a joke, which is true, because he's his own sort of satirical comment in a way. Hardly any need for the rest of us.
You just write down what he says and that's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but he is great to draw because he's got... what happens for people like myself, I think, is that, first of all, when they're new on the stage, you have to get a likeness. Sounds obvious, but you do it. It's not always easy. But that's the first thing. And then you gradually add to it. Because you notice things. There are things like with Trump, he's got this orange complexion, which we all know about, but he's also got these white circles around his eyes, which presumably are from the sunbed, you know, specs, dark specs, and, you know, they come off and then there's only a white there. So you notice that, and that's the way you draw it. Same with his hair, of course, which I think those of us who have to study these things knew that it was real early on. Whereas, you know, when he was becoming president, there was this big, you know, debate. Is it real, that hair and all the rest of it? Well, it is.
If you were going to have fake, you wouldn't have.
The money he's got, you're going to
pay for that.
But that's good to do.
Is the key for you, in a way, is to spot the things that the reader hasn't spotted? And that's what gives the likeness. And it's presumably the same with you,
Janice. It's interesting what you're saying there about, you know, you have to get the likeness and then you build on it. And that's sort of the same with with a vocal or physical impression. Mm-hmm. You want to make it accurate, but you have to add something.
Yes.
You have to be saying something about it.
Yes.
And I think with an impression, it's like you see people so that they say, you know, they recognise it. You make people recognise something that they see and they recognize it, but they just hadn't realized
it
before. So you crystallize it for them.
Yeah,
you sort of put it in a little nugget and you go, oh yeah, she does that.
Yes,
You know, and that's what's kind of a joy of it, really, is that people go, oh yeah, you know, and they get that sort of pleasure in the recognition in the sort of layer that you're adding. Because in both our things, we're sort of we're saying, you know, here it is, but here's the added value.
I was just going to say, just to add to that, but with Trump, you get the whole package because it's not just the look, which is what we've been talking about, but you get the speech as well. And for someone like me who has to have captions, that's kind of important. And it doesn't happen with anyone else, or it doesn't with me. But with him, you know, all the O's are elongated. Every second word is beautiful, and so on and so on and so on. And it just adds to the... fun, if you like, or taking the piss a little bit more widely, you know, when you can do that with, you know, do a bit of what you do, really, basically. Not with Trump, obviously.
Did it become easier for you when you were doing Dead Ringers on television, when you were having to think about how they look as well as how they sound? Did that make you get into the character more, or was it actually an extra layer that detracted from the voice of it?
It's an interesting question because it sort of divides people down the middle, really. Lots of people used to sort of say, I much preferred it on radio because you could, you know, you had the voice and you could imagine the real person in your head as the listener. Whereas with the television, while it was great fun to dress up as these people, it was also very expensive and very time consuming. And always when you dress up, if I were to dress up as Theresa May, which I have done, there are a couple of films on YouTube of me as Theresa May, and you know, it's not a bad likeness, you know, it's a pretty good wig, and I, you know, put the eye bags on and all that, bless her, and you know, it's not a bad likeness, but on something like Dead Ringers, you know, people would say, well, you know, you didn't quite look like that person, and you didn't, and you'd have spent like 3 or 4 hours having a prosthetic put on, you know, in order to get an accurate likeness, and sometimes it sort of isn't worth it. I mean, I used to sort of think with Rory Bremner, you know, very often the most impressive part of his show was the monologue where he just went from one to the other to the other to the other to the other, and you kind of
no dressing,
you felt the character. Yes. I mean, I loved doing Dead Ringers on the telly. I did absolutely love it, and it was great fun dressing up. And the great thing about telly, of course, is that you. Well, in those days, you reached a wider audience. I mean, now I think the radio, our radio podcast is the BBC's most downloaded programme. And so it does reach a huge audience. And I think radio started to do that again.
I must say, I've recently discovered it's excellent for listening to while jogging.
Oh, really?
Well, because it's sort of, I sort of forget that I hate jogging.
Yeah.
But I sort of forget about it because I end up sort of laughing along to die now. Right.
You feel you're being pursued by Theresa May and
Rumpelstiltskin. Exactly, yeah. I've got to get home first. To what extent, Patrick, when you're writing a sketch, do you feel you're making a political point? Is it just about the jokes, or do you convey your own sort of political persuasion or views?
Good question. I will always find that whichever way the column might lean, I'll get comments underneath from people saying that I'll be biased against the other way. I suppose, unlike Peter and Jan, I often focus on the peripheral characters that no one's ever heard of, and that's part of the fun. So actually it's not about making a political point about what was happening yesterday, but looking at the sort of the eccentric farmyard creatures who are around it. And so I quite enjoy, you know, you're not really making a political point when you're writing about Jacob Rees-Mogg or Michael Fabricant or someone like that. But there are times when I watch PMQs, for instance, and I will think Corbyn's had a dreadful day or May's had a really good day or vice versa. And I'll write that and then I'll get terribly worried about people thinking I'm trying to... when really I just want to write jokes about it.
Yeah. Well, there is at the moment... I was having an argument with somebody with Twitter about this only this morning. This idea, and in fact Hugo Rifkin's written it in the Times as well, this idea that if you criticise one party leader... there's this sort of culture now that you must therefore be a fully paid-up member of the opposing party. Because all you're doing is passing comment on somebody's had a bad day or somebody's...
They never notice the times you've criticised the other side.
No,
so there's
exactly
one
right.
reader, hello Nigel, if you're listening, who, if I'm rude about Corbyn, will always say I'm a Tory stooge. But when I'm rude about Theresa May, he just won't leave a comment at all.
Yes.
And that's slightly irritating because I feel I'm fairly equal opportunities rudeness. but that's part of the game. I just try and be fair. I'm trying to report it as I see it.
Obviously,
but,
I think
the joke matters more.
Yes, the joke matters more. And also, I think if there's a party in government, you're bound to criticise them more because, you know,
they're doing stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So you're bound to criticise them more. I mean, on Dead Ringers, you know, I do Theresa May, but I also do Diane Abbott, who, you know, has great difficulty waking up.
Oh, I see that from the gallery. Watch her, you see her head nod.
That is the key. You know, that is the key to doing Diane Abbott. It's just like, you know, always just been woken up from a really nice nap. Tony.
Do you, is that sort of BBC balance? If you do Theresa, you've got to do Diane. How much is there at the Dead Ringers about?
There is quite a bit of concern. I mean, the BBC is, you know, I think the BBC is very much sort of on the back foot at the moment. You know, it's very keen to be seen to be equal opportunities rudeness, as Patrick so succinctly puts it. I think, you know, you do have to, if I mean, and there are some programmes, I think, where you can say, well, you know, you're all a bunch of lefties. But I don't think that's true on Dead Ringers. And I think, you know, that there's been a lot of stuff about Corbyn and about Diane Abbott, as well as all the stuff about Theresa May. But obviously, yeah, as I say, the government's bound to get most of the stick.
Presumably, is your job more fun because we've got a female prime minister?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, about bleeding time, you know, because when I was doing Spitting Image, Margaret Thatcher was played by Steve Nallon. You know, it was played by a man, and you know, indeed portrayed as a man. You know, where she had the suit on, you know, and the cabinet were all complete wimps, and Steve Nallon did her brilliantly, but it was slightly galling that, you know, our first female prime minister played by a man.
Waited a long time, and still,
yeah.
And with the dynamic, there is this sort of, she obviously endures huge amounts of unacceptable abuse on social media and that sort of thing. Do you worry when you're doing her? That you're feeding into, and I know a couple of times I've stepped in for Patrick doing the sketch, and when I've written about her in the Red Box email, there's a bit feeling slightly nervous about saying things about Diane because of this.
Well, I have this line where I say, I refuse to be judged by the colour of my skin. It's only by the stupidity of the things that I say. and I think, you know, she does get a lot of really, really terrible abuse, partly because she's black and partly because she's a woman, and you know, mainly because she's both, and that is absolutely totally unacceptable, and I would never make a joke about her being black except to say that, you know, it isn't about her being black, it's about the fact that she hasn't got a very good eye for detail, and she sometimes seems to be rather lazy and not have a grasp of her material, and you know, that's what you're satirising with her. And this idea, this sort of idea that, you know, she's just been woken up. It's sort of like, you know, and then, of course, when she revealed that she was ill, actually, I was thinking, oh, my goodness, I hope she hasn't got, you know, something really... I mean, diabetes is not great, but it's manageable.
And Theresa May has it.
And Theresa May has it.
A different time. Yeah. I censored myself over Diana. I rarely feel I go too far, but it was her first Home Office questions after the election, and I was up in the gallery in the chamber, and for a start, Jeremy Corbyn was sitting on the front bench, which was weird. You don't need the leader of your party there to hold your hand. And she got up to the dispatch box, and I suddenly became aware she had her hands clasped and she was really shaking, and as the question went on, it was like that, and I watched it back on television just to see it wasn't a trick, and I started to write, you know, and then I thought, gosh, is this a symptom of her diabetes? And I googled and said, "Camp." I thought, well, perhaps that's being unfair. I mean, I suspect she was just terrified because she'd had such criticism. But so I put, she looked visibly nervous, but I didn't start talking about the handshake because I thought that was going too far.
Too cool.
I then did the sketch, and my regular reader Nigel, who hates every time I read about Corbyn, said, "Well, I noticed you didn't write about Theresa May today." and I replied saying she wasn't in the chamber, she didn't need to go there and hold Amber Rudd's hand like Jeremy Corbyn did. But that is an example of how you can never win. But I mean, do you ever sense yourself, do you feel you go too far? And
Yeah, I
do you get feedback from your victims?
Not from the victims, just their supporters. No, very rare, although I do hear by your sort of whatever trail it is sometimes that you know, when I've upset somebody. I did with Nick Clegg a fair bit, actually. I used to get messages about, not from his camp necessarily, but from people that he took against.
How did you portray him?
As David Cameron's fan.
Oh, right, yes.
He's always being beaten up and sort of his feet held to the fire and, you know, sort of given sort of bog baths and all the rest of it. Well, you know, he sort of kind of came in for that. I'm afraid that was his own fault.
Do you ever feel like you're being too cruel? Is there such a thing as being too cruel to a politician?
Well, by definition, I suppose there is. It depends on the circumstance and whether they deserve it or not at that particular time. I'm not sort of a cartoonist who thinks that all politicians are evil and to hell with the lot of them and, you know, sort of just lay in for the sake of it at all. They've got to have done something or said something or pretended something to make it, you know, to make the point. I mean, you were asking your question earlier about, you know, having, you know, a political stance or a... my whole point is that, you know, I don't do a drawing without the political idea first, and you've got to have the, you know, the idea before you can hook the drawing onto it, and it's that way around.
And just on the sort of practicalities of how your day works, when do you decide... How do you decide, and when do you decide your what you're going to do as the cartoon, and how long does it then take to sort of appear as a finished.
Oh, right. Well, it's a day's work.
Yeah.
And some people say, is that all you do all day? You know?
Never tried to paint anything. It's amazing.
But it's a cartoon and people think that's a sort of kind of an easy life.
Yeah.
But no, I start off with the Today programme first thing in the morning and it just goes on through. And after going to conference at the Times, because I work from the building, I then work out what the subject is going to be. And then,
excuse me for interrupting. That's quite interesting. Don't lose your thread. But it's quite interesting that you work in the building.
Yeah.
I mean, so few people in your position would do that now. But does that make you feel more kind of in the thick of things and where there are ideas flying around?
Yeah, it's so much. I mean, I used to do both. I mean, I've done both, put it that way. I've worked from home for a long time. And then when I got a regular sort of position on the Times, I came in. It's just so much better because you're not in isolation in the sense that you can show things around as this work. You know, all the material that you need, the ancillary stuff, all the pictures you want, all the... Well, you can get a lot now just from Googling things, I know, so you could easily do it at home to a degree, but not to the degree you can do
here.
That's
really interesting.
And actually, I just like you discuss things more, you discuss politics more. Than speaking to the wall.
Do
you think it makes it sort of newsier as well? So instead of digesting yesterday's news in papers at home, you're sort of in the newsroom and...
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
You are able to sort of access absolutely the latest stuff, you know. But then I have a cut-off point anyway, you know, which is sort of about 3-4 o'clock, where I know that it's going to be difficult to... You know, about this time. I know it's difficult to turn around a drawing, but sometimes things break very late, some really major things, and you've just got to be prepared to rip up what you were doing and start again, you know, quickly.
And so roughly how long does it take then to when you've got your idea?
Right, I finish at 8, basically.
Right.
And I could go on a bit longer. I'm not sure exactly how much longer. I haven't really tested that one. But I don't... you know, I don't finish early.
Yeah.
I can't, I'm not the sort of, you can finish at 4 o'clock and go home. Although you can sometimes, you can have your idea first. I mean, I got the idea for what I'm doing for tomorrow between 12 and 1 today, which meant I could have finished it probably by about 4 and gone off home if I'd wanted. But something always happens. or someone says something more, or something you can add to, or do you know what I mean? And the last thing you want to do is to fall flat on your face and look as though you haven't been following what's been going on. Because, you know, it'd be awful if some cataclysmic thing happened at 5 o'clock and you were just swanning around, you know, sort of on the way home.
And also, presumably, you don't want to spend all that time doing one of your amazing cartoons and then have to sort of bin it because something else has happened. If you've got to embark on that big job, you only want to do.
Well, I'm never too worried about that.
Okay,
you know, I mean, if something more, there's a wonderful thing that happens to us all. I don't know whether it's the same doing radio, but adrenaline is a wonderful thing, and it does, you know, sort of keep you just on the ball, really, and you're keen to do it. That's the point. You know, if something big enough did happen, I'd be more than willing to chop what I was doing and start again.
Because you get inspired, don't you? You go, oh, yes, that's it.
And is that similar in when you're recording something like Dead Ringers? How much of it is sort of being rewritten as you go along? What's the sort of process for what we hear then on the Friday?
Well, I think they have a writer's meeting on the Tuesday. The recording's done on the Thursday. So we the performers come in on a Thursday afternoon at 2 and see the script.
Yeah.
We read it through, we sort of discuss it, we say, what about doing this, what about doing that? And then the writers do a bit of rewriting, and then we do a run through on the microphone, and then we do it. So that's all very quick. But as for the writing process, that's kind of, you know, it's percolating all the time. I mean, there are times where we've had to be very reactive, like on the referendum, the Brexit referendum, and the election, where we were recording for the Friday broadcast, the Friday 6:30 broadcast, but because the elections were on the Thursday, they had to write the show really sort of through the night and during that morning for us to record it on the Friday lunchtime, and then Bill had to very quickly edit it on the Friday afternoon, and then it went out on the Friday evening. But they were so exciting, You know, they were so great that they felt it made me sort of realise why people love working in news, because there's that sort of thing of like that adrenaline of kind of we're really
the
doing something.
Empty page, yes.
You know,
Simon Barnes, our former chief sports writer, was once, I wrote about this in one of his books. He was asked, "What do you do when you're doing a late night football match and you have 15 minutes to file a piece at the end of the game, and you don't have enough time to write a really good piece?" He said, "I write a bad piece. What's the other option?"
Yeah.
And Patrick, while we're on the subject, just talk us how do you always know what you're going to do the sketch on? Do you go to lots of things and then decide what you're going to...
Well, I have to do the diary column each day as well.
Of course.
And so I try and work... I try and decide early on what I might sketch, but sometimes it will just become apparent. I work down in the Commons. We have a porter cabin on the roof there.
glamorous.
It is very glamorous.
Installed in 1970, condemned as unsafe in 1994.
It's still there.
And so sometimes you'll be aware something's going on and you'll zip down to the chamber. But generally, I sort of focus... If I'm not watching something in the chamber that I'll sketch, I'll focus on the diary. That gets done at 6-ish. I don't then start writing the sketch normally till 6:30. And I try and get that done by 8:30. And there is the adrenaline, as you talk about, the fear. And, you know, sometimes, to be honest, you just go to the bar. And my very first sketch, because I was desperate to make a good impression, was about Nigel Farage. It was probably in keeping with Nigel Farage. I went off and had 3 pints before I started writing it, and it put me in the right spirit. But, you know, it just has to be done. And so in the election, when we had the debates, the Newsnight debates and stuff like that, that was a case of filing within 30 minutes of it finishing. And you have some idea, you sort of write half the sketch in advance, and then most of it gets chucked out, but you've got that safety net. And other days, you can be watched a question time in the morning, and you've got it the whole day for it to percolate around in your head, and sometimes your ideas might change. The lovely thing is when something happens very late in the day. I remember the Syria debate, December 2016, and Hillary Benn gave this fabulous speech. Whatever you think about the force of which way he was arguing, it was a brilliantly delivered speech with his leader beside him, who clearly hated every word of it. Yeah. And the paper went at 10 o'clock, and I think I was able to... I'd written a first draft on Cameron and Corbyn's speeches and tickled in a little, and then had to rewrite it entirely on Ben, and it was the sketch began with "This was the mouse that roared," because it was completely out of character that he would give this defiant, and I loved that. Writing something in 30 minutes is good fun.
Well, it just goes to show, if you've got a deadline, you can have all day mucking about, and then you end up having to do it right at the end. My deadline's much earlier, because when I write the red box email, I have to have it done by 7:30, because it has to be subbed, and like you said, you can't have a blank page. You just have to get on and write something and hope that...
There is the advantage that the later you leave it, the less chance there are for the subs to change it.
That is absolutely right. But that's all we've got time for in part one of our end of term special. Join us in part two, when we'll be doing a quiz to find out who's been paying most attention during the year, plus finding out what the panel's highlights or maybe lowlights of the political year so far have been. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on your Android device so the episode arrives as if by magic. And you can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. For now, from Jan, Peter, Patrick and me, it's goodbye.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.